Welcome to Humans of Magic. My guest this week is Everett Mohan, aka Aspiring Spike. This is actually the second time that I had Spike on the show, and we just had a wonderful conversation about his 2023 year in review, which included not only streaming Magic, but also his deck building process and getting into other very difficult games, plus his preparation at the Pro Tours, where he got to work with very high level players like Reed Duke and Kai Buddha. All in all, I think it was a great journey into the creative process of Spike's mind, what really makes him the Magic player that he is, and I'm so delighted to present this conversation to you. So without further ado, here's my talk with Aspiring Spike.
Last year was a really, really interesting year where I started off and I was wanting to branch into like variety streaming a little bit, where I would do my normal Magic stream, and for like 3 or 4 months I was trying to beat, are you familiar with the game Dark Souls?
Yes, extremely excruciatingly hard and skill-based, right?
Yeah, I was trying to beat the game without taking a hit was my goal on stream. There's some other streamers that I'm a big fans of, Dino Sagile and the Happy Hob. This is like what they do full time, is they play the Dark Souls games and they beat them without taking a hit. They've actually done.
And you're really good at the game, right? Like, don't get.
That's actually kind of the thing, is I think I'm not really that good at video games naturally, but I've spent a lot of time on them and like working on them, but my reflexes aren't that good, and I don't think I'm naturally that good. But that was kind of also, I think, the appeal was to like watch me go from really bad and like the first few. So I spent like a full month, probably 2 hours a day off stream, practicing the route to beat Dark Souls no hit. And at the point I had done each individual section off stream no hit, and that took me like 2 months to get to. That's when I started streaming it. And even at that point, the attempts were like excruciatingly bad. It took a long time before I would like consistently get deep runs. And I managed to beat the game one hit, and I managed to get like 80% through the game as my my personal bests. And I was getting really close, but I was also starting to get kind of burned out. And this was in like May of last year that this was happening. And then I also happened to spike regional championship Dallas, and I qualified for Pro Tour Barcelona. And that was a huge, huge tournament for me to qualify for, because it was the first modern Pro Tour back since the Pro Tours had returned. It was Pro Tour Lord of the Rings, which was a set that I consulted on. And it was also, you know, it being modern, I've been primarily a modern streamer for a really long time. It was a tournament I really, really wanted to play at. So at that point, I kind of like dropped the Dark Souls stuff to completely focus on that Pro Tour testing. And the trip to Europe and the trip to Barcelona was by far the highlight of my year. It was just so many special memories from that trip. I got engaged on that trip in Italy, and it was awesome. And like since then, things have kind of like been returning to normal, settling down a little bit, playing, you know, some tournaments here and there, just focusing on like on Magic. And I've been, you know, kind of thinking about what it is like, what this year is going to be like, since that was like really the defining moment for me last year.
Can I go back and ask you about the Dark Souls? What was the main motivation to get into that? Was it some sort of malaise with Magic, or was it something else?
It was something that I had always wanted to do. So when I first started playing that game, like 8 or 9 years ago, it was so like difficultly frustrating to me that I gave up. Like I couldn't get through the game, and I maybe returned to it like 9 months later, and it took me so long to just,
because it's so punishing, right? I didn't play it, but from watching people play, it just looks absolutely punishing.
Yeah, and you just get a little bit better at it each time you play it. And there's something about playing the game that's so like almost mesmerizing, immersive. I just really love it in a way that I haven't been as attached to other games. And like years ago, towards the beginning of my stream, when I was like not doing it as a full-time job, it was more of a hobby, I would also stream Dark Souls like just at night, and I would stream it like when there was Magic Online maintenance. And I had been like just casually attempting to beat the game without dying off stream, and I attempted it on stream, and I just got it on my second try. And doing that on stream was really fun. And like I just jokingly said, yeah, one day we'll do it no hit. And then I was watching other streamers who play these games professionally, and they do all of the games at once, no hit. And I just kind of thought, you know, if I'm ever going to do this, it like probably should be now, while I'm, you know, still more interested in it and younger and I don't have kids yet. And like, I kind of felt like it was, I mean, I'm either going to do it now or I'm never going
to
do it.
I assume your reflexes get worse over time. Yeah. Like, I used to be able to, you know, play Mega Man really well. I can't do anywhere near what I was. So maybe you're thinking that as well, perhaps.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was thinking. And, you know, I still haven't done it. I did a little bit of practice in December. But it was tough to, I was wanting to return to the Dark Souls streams last month, but I also had like big tournament in Atlanta. I had like two formats to balance, which is always so time consuming. And I also got pretty sick. So it ended up being delayed again, but it would be really cool to return to it at some point this year. I'm hoping to find the time, but I'm definitely someone that likes to jump into a lot of personal projects off stream, and it's for me, it's really hard to complete any of them because I also do so much off stream prep for my work, where like right now I'm working on like getting my aquarium decor set up really well. I'm working on a tabletop TRPG with one of my friends. We're designing the system and working on the mechanics. My friends are, we just actually finished a nice D&D table for our group where we've been sanding it, and it's got like LEDs on the side and like laptop mats. I've been like trying to write a novel, and so like,
oh my goodness.
Yeah, so I just have a lot of like projects, and usually my like structure is I wake up, I have my stream prepped, I do that, I take like a 2-hour break, and then I do prep the next day's stream, and then I'll jump into like one of my various projects. And for a long time that was like the Dark Souls no hit stuff, and lately it's just been these other things.
That's a lot of dedication. And I also want to ask you about okay, I'm coming from a complete place of kind of ignorance here, but I'm trying to figure out, like, it's so fascinating to me how you're like practicing 2 hours a day, as you said, and you're really like working on the no hit thing for Dark Souls, and then it sounds like there's some sort of systematic training that you're applying, right? Like, how did you know what to do when you're practicing off stream? Is there like some sort of systematic approach, or is there like a best practice, or you just basically just like, I'm just gonna grind this section to have no hit and just do it like day after day after day?
Yeah, so it just kind of depends on I guess what you're struggling with day after day. I'm someone who very, very much believes in effective practice and effective work too, where there's like a long time, especially like in my early 20s when I was like working on projects or working on work or working on school, I felt like my studying or my work was just ineffective. Like I was putting in hours and I wasn't feeling like I was getting like the results of those hours, if that makes sense. And so
it was more mindless, it was less intentional, sort of.
Yeah. So I don't know when exactly, but my practice started to become very intentional, where, like, for example, in the Dark Souls stuff, there's like tutorials online where I would like very like focus, like I would study each section individually, and I would go through that section over and over and over until it was just memorized, until I could visualize it in my head, do the next section, do it all at once. And then there's a software that lets you save specific spots, and you can go back and practice them over and over and over again. And I have detailed notes on each section and what needs improvement and like in different stuff. And just, it's kind of hard to articulate because when you play video games or you play Magic, this stuff is supposed to be fun and it's supposed to be relaxing.
Sounds like work. This sounds like you're actually like, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's kind of what I'm getting at, is that if you don't treat it like that and you treat it like a project and you treat it like work, for me it's way more fulfilling. It's like being able to like have like this end goal. Like in Magic, it's really the same goal every time. Build a deck in a new creative way and get to share that idea, and like in a way and just like crush these like ideas into diamonds, and like really be very, very disciplined with how you build your decks. That's something that I feel like kind of what sets out my brewing is that I just don't play these things if I don't think there's any kind of good idea, and I like really work with them for a long time until they're hammered out off stream and there's something like to show, something that's exciting. And it takes a lot of time, and it's not, I think, as fun necessarily as just like playing some goofy cards or like trying to pull off some sweet combo. And a lot of times it's just not as successful as I want it to be. And but that's what's fun about it, because like after all of this like work and grind, when these brews do pay off and when they are successful and they are fewer and farther between than I like, but when they are, it's just the most satisfying thing ever. And it's kind of the same thing for like the Dark Souls no hit stuff too, where it's a lot of pain and it's very repetitive and it's very frustrating. But every time you get a personal best, every time you go forward, you can feel that progress and you can feel it pay off and you feel like you're a better version of yourself.
What do you think is the divide between being able to do it well off camera and then doing it well on stream or on camera? Because is there some sort of, let's just be real here, right? I'm genuinely curious. Is there some sort of additional pressure like you're doing in front of other people? Is it like the fact that you have to do it in one take? Like, what exactly is it for you?
Do you mean like, we're talking about the Dark Souls or the like?
We're talking about Dark Souls. Yeah, okay. Sorry to clarify, because okay, you're just saying you were able to do no hit off camera, and then you got one hit, which is still pretty freaking amazing.
Oh,
That's still 99%.
I didn't do no hit off camera. I practiced a lot.
Oh, okay, okay. And I assume there was some like difference in results, like doing it off camera and on camera.
Like I could do. I've done each individual section, and I've probably broken it up to 20 sections, hunt like dozens and dozens of times each. Individually, yeah. but to do it all at once, yeah, is there's
in
a
one
there's
take
a,
one go.
In one the one take there's a combination of like RNG and uh-huh. We're like it's like the way the different AI interacts, like sometimes it's just very easy and sometimes it's increasingly more difficult, and then also it's a lot like playing a poker tournament too, where you just have spots where you feel like you have good percentages and you just have to go mm-hmm. all in. And so for the Quelaag boss fight, I'm probably like 75% to beat Quelaag no hit every time I try. For Ornstein and Smo, I'm probably like 30-35. That's the hardest part by a lot. I'm like 35 to beat it any given time. Nito is like 80%, Seath is like 90%, Four Kings is like 40%. And so it's like you just have to win all those coin flips,
right,
or
you
like
multiply the EV together. Yeah,
the odds are like pretty low, and this is this is also how like the professional no hit runners are too. They get better and better, and their percentage to like beat any section at any given time goes up.
Oh, so now 75 becomes 80 or something like that.
Yeah, 75 becomes 80 for them, and they get better, but they still have to like win that 80%, and then they have to win a 90% after that, and then the 70, and they have to do that all in a row.
Oh, so it might actually be like, I don't want to say like a dozen tries or something to actually get a no hit. Like 1 in 12 tries, you might actually get that. Otherwise,
yeah,
you don't.
Like the people who do it professionally, it can take them like 8 months, 9 months, a year to get like some of these really, really difficult ones, like doing them full time every day, 10 hours a day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Was it also hard for you in terms of stream? Because I understand that people come to a stream expecting something, so your viewership numbers might have taken a hit during that time.
Yeah, they did. I would probably be at like, you know, my normal like 1200 for Magic, and then when I would switch to Dark Souls, it would be like 400-500 ish after that. But and this is also like going from Magic to Souls, where if I would just start Dark Souls, I'd be like 300-400 total. But you know, one thing that's like really important, I think, to understand as a Twitch streamer is like, if you switch to something else that's not getting as many views, it doesn't like negatively impact your main thing, as long as like you're still also doing that content. Like people will come back and people will watch like the stuff that they want to watch. And the people who do watch like your more specialized niche content, there may not be as many people watching, but you kind of, I think, form like a more special connection with them, where the audience gets smaller and it's like a little bit more intimate. And it's also like the Dark Souls stuff especially was like sweaty and grindy and difficult. And it's like, it's an experience to like go through together with your audience. And like, I still have a lot of people today asking to like return.
Like that,
to
that is yeah. really real, right? I don't even know like a better adjective. Like that, that is real. That's some real shit.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. I think it's real, and I think it's fun to like go through that with the people who have like the time and energy and interest to go through that with you. And I don't feel like I just really sweat numbers very much, because something I've really learned is like at this point, if I'm engaged and having fun and I'm interested, then there are some people who will be there. And I think that's always for me, especially in the magic category, especially, it's just my numbers are always the highest when I'm doing the thing I'm the most interested in. And
okay, there's a correlation.
Yeah, there's a very big correlation. And so that's also like, and I'm also very interested in, you know, finding new ideas and sharing them all the time. And so it ends up being a really good system to have.
What is your deck building process now? How has it evolved?
I feel like last year was in a lot of ways a lot better than any year previously. I feel like I am getting a lot better at, it's kind of hard to articulate without like boasting too much, but I think I could probably like inverse boast and talk about how, like in my first 2-3 years of streaming, a lot of my decks were like very similar. I played a lot of fair decks. What I would do is I would take like existing like mid-range control tempo style archetypes and like have very like small updates to them. And this was like what I wanted to share. And there's nothing wrong with that. I still do that occasionally. But this last year, I think I had a lot of like very unconventional deck building and like really challenging existing formulas for how decks are built, and really like pushing the boundaries and finding like very, very interesting shells and formula and success with that. And I was very proud of doing that. But my process in general has always been, I have an idea and then I try to maximize the idea to the fullest extent. I'll take an idea for either building around a card, building a deck in this unique formula, innovating an archetype, and I try to find every iteration that looks reasonable around the idea, every different version of it, find the very best one, and then at that point, either I think the idea is not good enough, which probably happens 50% of the time at this point, it just gets scrapped after spending time on it. Then the 50% that don't, they get tested off stream, and then I'd say probably, usually if I think the idea is good enough, it like probably makes it to the stream 60 to 70% of the time. From that point of like the 50 that made it here, and usually changes will happen over the brewing process or the deck building off stream, and then the decks make it to the stream, and it is usually the case that I play a deck exactly one time after like I almost always spend more time off stream on a deck than on, and usually a deck gets played for 1, 2, maybe 3 leagues, and then I don't come back to it. And then the ones I do come back to, these are the more successful ones. These are the ones that I think have the highest prospects. And I end up going through like a few different versions of them on stream. And then a lot of times I will feel like the idea is like solved. The deck list is like just about as maximized as it can be. And I just stop working on it. If I feel like there's nothing left to do, it's like as good as we can get it, I just leave it alone for a long time. And if it's sometimes we circle back, sometimes we don't, but usually that's the process. Just try to make your ideas as tuned as possible.
Okay. So an incredible amount of work even to get it eligible for on stream, because you have to actually, as you said, prepare and play with it offline, make sure that it has legs. And then once you play it on stream, how do you know whether to continue playing that deck or working on that deck? Is it based on the results of that stream, or is it just some sort of feeling or a combination?
It's a combination. Like this is a question I get asked a lot, but there's a few different, like I mostly like evaluate the games themselves, where I've had brews that like my first like 10 matches with them have gone really poorly, but I still think the deck is good and I continue working on it. And I
feel that potential. Yeah. And maybe inversely, there's brews that like you're doing well on stream, but they're not actually that good.
5-0'd with decks that I feel like are awful. I've like done really well with stuff that I think is awful, and I usually try to be very honest with that. That's the case that I don't think this deck is that good, but we're running pretty hot with it. It actually happened like last week with this like Eldrazi Promised in deck I was playing. We like 5-0'd and 4-1 with it, but I'm still kind of, I don't think that deck is that good. But It's like in modern, like there's a very interesting dynamic where most of the decks are synergy based, or they have these super duper powerful draws, and it kind of doesn't matter what you're playing. Like if your opponent is just like if your Amulet Titan opponent is killing you on turn three on the play, if your Tron opponent has natural Tron, this kind of stuff. Like you don't need to sweat these games so much. Like it just kind of depends on like what archetype you're playing. Like do you have game against these? Obviously these factors all matter. But like if your opponents are drawing super well against you, they're doing their thing. They're doing their top 10%. They do it twice over a game. You don't need to sweat it so much. You can keep evaluating the deck. Conversely, like if you're like you can experience like negative variance and just like push through it. Like if I you know have like no lander one no lander seven lander multi five and I do that twice over the course of a match.
Sure, there's some non games you can just kind of take out of your sample, right?
Yeah, but for the most part, I think like you know most games aren't like this, and you can and the biggest thing also to evaluate too is like most of the time your brews involve like a unique idea, a unique formula, a new card, and then a bunch of good cards too. Like this is when you're building a good brew, you're going to have a pile of modern staples and like powerful effects around your new idea. And if you're just not drawing that aspect of your deck too, if you're not drawing like what the ideas you're trying to test, you don't need to like win or lose. You don't need to put a lot of stock into.
Right. Cause then you're not really evaluating the core, right?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And so it's kind of like all of these factors too. Like for me, the process is a lot of like ignoring the stuff that doesn't matter, like the variance on your side, your opponent's side, not drawing what you're trying to test, and just focusing on what it is you're trying to test and doing it like as quickly as possible. And also like listening to feedback from chat members too is very helpful. And there's a lot of times that chatters have, you know, good ideas on how to build decks differently, and then we get like really weird and lost in the sauce. And like sometimes sometimes like especially when things are going really poorly on stream, and this is, you know, not super often, but it's very very fun when it happens, there'd just be like a really cool idea that's so exciting as we'll just build it on stream, we'll build it together, and then we'll play it. And
okay, disgusted with what's happening that you're just like, let's just take a detour, right? Let's just do something else. This is not fun.
Lost in the sauce, and it's something that has to happen very organically, I think, but when it happens, it's really fun.
Okay, so lost in the sauce can be for good, or it can also be for bad. It's just going in an unforeseen direction.
Yeah, I'd say so.
So I guess the unscientific answer you've given me is like, it's just vibes. Like, it's just like, sometimes it feels right, sometimes it doesn't.
Yeah, I don't like saying that, but yeah, it is for me.
No, I mean, you built up so much experience, so it's really hard to, as you said before in another answer, it's like, sometimes it's hard to articulate the thing, but you know it when you see it, or you know it when you feel it, right?
Yeah, like, modern is such a weird format where there's like, so many like unconventional, like unmathematical, unformulaic aspects to deck building that are like very synergy based, and like so much of it is like based on experience and like past failures, that it's just, it is tough to articulate, but I very vibe based.
Were there particular decks that really stood out? You mentioned like having some breakthroughs and going beyond what you typically brew. Can you give me a few examples?
I mean, I think the biggest example from this last year was the Cascade Bean deck, where Up the Beanstalk came out. I was playing a lot with it, and the card was so good. It's now banned. It's
card
now
is
banned.
Absolutely nuts.
It's like I think even still people don't really understand why it was so good and why it's banned. But like one thing that I think helps some people understand is like the card was literally never ever bad to draw at any point in the game. Because it's 2 mana, you could draw any number of them at any point in the game and you're happy. Like you compare this to like the One Ring, it's still a 4 mana spell. If you have like two of them in your opening hand and you have two lands, like you just have to mulligan. If you have, you know, any number of beanstalks are always good. And so this was something like this was like exactly like what I had articulated on stream one day. And like and I was like saying it out loud and kind of understanding it for myself. And then I saw some lists online that were like Rhinos decks that had like beans in the sideboard, or they had a split of like Crashing Footfalls and Rhinos Crashing Footfalls and Up the Beanstalk in the deck at the same time to cascade into off of Shardless Agent. And then I'm like, well, Up the Beanstalk is just, it's so strong, and it is just better than Crashing Footfalls. And I took the four color deck, and I like the four color Omnath control deck, and I just put Charlotte's Agent and Bloodbraid Elf and Up the Beanstalk in it. And I just cut Ridden Six, and I cut like the one mana removal spells, which you don't need because you have Fury and Solitude and Leyline Binding. Yeah. And that deck was crazy. It was like it took off really, really fast. It became like just how the four color decks were built, like very, very quickly. It was like almost immediately like one of the decks in Modern to beat. And it was like, I think like at the time, the idea of like cutting Ridden Six, cutting one mana removal spells from like the four color Omnath decks was just crazy. Cutting those for Shardless Agent.
So it didn't feel obvious in the moment.
No,
only in hindsight. Yeah.
And also cutting the One Ring too. Like this was something that this was like
sacrilegious.
Almost. But it was better. It was the best way to build the deck. And you started to be able to do crazy stuff like play Commandeer in the deck. It just got really like weird and inbred and like this crazy arms race to like beat the other Bean decks and like play Endurance in the main deck for the mirrors, play Jace, Wilder of Mysteries, and like it spiraled out of control where like it felt like the whole Modern community was doing it, and it like started on my channel, and it was really, really cool. It was very cool to be like the match that set the fire there. And it's like, it's just like such a rare moment to like, I say this very seriously, like to break Modern and like really change it like that it's very, very cool to do that live on stream. It is just
that's the crazy thing, isn't it, man? Like it's not obvious until it is, right?
Yeah.
Like people will just tell you this is insane until it's the de facto best thing to do.
Yeah, exactly. And I really like to try to challenge those deck building conventions and get weird with it and just try new stuff. Like I was doing that also with like Amulet of Vigor decks last year. I was having like a lot of success with like these weird builds with Timeless Lotus and Golos over like the Primeval Titan stuff where I think the deck is like faster and you play like a few.
And that's legit, not lost in the sauce. That's legit sauce.
I mean, I've played it a ton and won a lot with it. I think that like, I think the deck is occasionally a better choice than Amulet Titan. It has to be like a very specific meta where there's a lot of creature removal and not a lot of like disenchants, which we're not in that environment right now at all. But like finding a different formula besides Amulet of Titan, I thought was like for an Amulet of, besides a Primeval Titan build, for an Amulet of Vigor build, I thought was really, really exciting. That was another like really big breakthrough, I think, from last year.
Now those are breakthroughs, but what motivates you to go after that? Is it just some sort of creative impulse? Is it some sort of need? Is it just like I can do better than what's out there? Or is it just like, this is who I am? Like, I'm trying to understand what drives you to kind of go outside of your range, or there's never been a range, or it's always been all universal, all encompassing. I don't know.
It's kind of dumb to say it like this, but it started from Crokey. You know Crokey's, he had a tweet where he said Magic content is lazy and boring to watch. And I was like just starting streaming.
Okay, so you were Michael Jordan and you felt slighted.
No. I was just starting to stream at the time.
I'm just kidding.
I was just trying to figure out what's going on. But like Crokey's was Michael Jordan, biggest Magic streamer, huge. And like the fact that he was saying that, and like, you know, it's funny because to him, like, I'm sure it was just like this dumb shit post and he's just like memeing. But to me, I'm like, he's right. He's right. Like it's so easy for Magic content to be like, I'm just going to scroll through MTG Goldfish. I'm going to pick a top 8 deck from the last weekend. I'm going to play it for the first time on stream. I'm going to give my thoughts on it after. This is like when I started streaming, this was just that's what Magic content was. Competitive Magic content was, look at last week's tournaments, pick one, don't change anything or change like a couple cards, play it, and then give your thoughts after. And like that tweet just sent me into like an existential crisis because I was just getting into it. I was trying to figure like out what I was doing and like how I was gonna like set myself apart from everybody else.
It's a throwaway tweet, but it's kind of true. It is true.
Yeah, it was true. And I just said like I don't want to be like that. I want to put in a lot of hours off stream, and I want to always come to where like I'm just sharing new ideas as often as I can and trying to innovate as often as I can. And to me, that has been incredibly fulfilling. I've made like lots of friends online and lots of good moments, and people get really excited about it. And it's just awesome. It's very, it satisfies that creative need. And it's very like, just you know, I think humans in general love to like pour work into something and see it pay off. And like, I've just found a way to like scratch that itch in a very formulaic routine way, which is awesome. And to me, it's become like a lot more fulfilling and interesting than tournament magic, which was kind of like my grind and passion before. And I still enjoy tournament magic, and I play it, you know, when I can, but to me, this is like my main thing and my main like love.
This is like your canvas, right? This is like where you do your art or do your work, I guess.
Yeah, that's what I would say that.
Hmm. That is really cool, because I don't know if you ever heard of the power law. I don't know if you've heard it described this way, but like essentially it's the idea that outsized rewards go to the top 1% of that profession, right? Like, for example, if you're Michael Jordan, you know, maybe there's like 5,000 magic basketball players that are close to you, but if you're the best, then you get all the rewards, all the spoils. I feel like for magic, you are kind of that for creative deck building, where one of the reasons that you took off was because you were zigging when others were zagging, or is it your, or others are zigging, you're zagging, but you're doing something that is almost, I don't want to say contrarian, but you're doing something that not a lot of people do, or I think even today, people don't do what you're doing. Maybe there's imitators that are trying, but like you're doing something that where you found a way to be like the 1% of your niche, so that you're taking all of it. You know what I mean? Like, because there isn't like a second aspiring spike, or if there is, like that person is second to you. You know?
Well, I do know what you mean, but I also like in a big way, like the reason that is kind of the case why I was doing things so differently before. One reason why it happened this way too was, I'm trying to say I wasn't very much in like the right, I was very much in the right place at the right time, where magic organized play in general was in a horrible position. Like I personally was in a spot where I just had, I played like my first pro tour of the season, and I had, I got one outed to not, it was the team Nashville Pro Tour. I got one outed to where I didn't top eight the event. Top four progressed the next day. It's not like I could have won, but that top eight would have put me like immediately requalified for the Pro Tour, immediately silver, very high chance to make gold. But still my finish where I was like 3 points away from silver, that would have given me another Pro Tour invite with 9 months left to make a gold run and like maybe make like a real chance for myself, a career for like actual pro play. And then like right when I'm in that position, they announced that they are doing away with pro tours, they're doing away with the pro point system, and they're introducing the MPL. And I had like this moment where I was like, I am just not interested in engaging with the game in the way anymore. Now the pro tours are leaving, organized play is changing, I'm going to start streaming. And I started streaming right when Modern Horizons 1 came out. And so this was a time where there was a lot of room to like try new things and brew and do all this stuff. And also like morale from streamers was like an all-time low. Morale for people playing Magic, playing Modern,
right,
at an all-time low. And not only
felt that, like we got punched in the gut, right?
Yeah. And also like Wizards at that time, and they've been like a little less so now, only interested in promoting arena streamers, only interested in like making very interested in making arena like the place to be if you're going to be a magical.
It was a dark time, and it wasn't your plan A. That's what you're saying. Your plan A was to like keep grinding that pro tour, get silver, get gold, and this was like a plan B that turned out to I guess through timing to become something, right?
Yeah, and it was just a very lucky time where people like when you say I was doing something that no one else was doing.
In retrospect or in hindsight, right?
I really feel like it's because like morale was very low. Like the best players, the MPL players, they have arena contracts, where they had to stream arena back then. They have to do all this. Other grinders like me are just quitting Magic. I was in a group of friends who would go to every tournament together, every RCQ, every PPTQ. I'm the only one of them that still plays Magic. And like it felt very right place, right time, because morale was like at such a low point, and people didn't think you could do like a full-time Magic online stream. And it was a long grind.
Yeah.
But it was also like right place because like Modern Horizons was like such a crazy revamp. And it was just really weird. And I really feel like things have opened up a lot over the last few years. And there are tons of great Magic streamers who are great, who are better than me, as good as me. And I think it's a really exciting time to be in the space. It's been healing a lot, I think is the right word. I think it's been getting better.
Magic is healing.
Yeah.
Well, then I'll use another cliche based on what you said, which is like, you know, it's all about that intersection of luck and opportunity, right? Because, yeah. And also hard work. It's like you have to work at it, but also you're not denying the fact that there were certain timing factors in the Modern Horizons release, and Modern was reinvigorated, and you're at the front of that reinvigoration, right?
Yeah, I think that is true. Like to some extent, like this has happened a couple times where there just like isn't a lot going on, or I can't find a lot going on. Like specifically, Crimson Vow was like just like the only set I've been streaming where there just was nothing to do. There was like things were stagnant. There were just not new cards to work on. And I like to say this a lot too. I don't make decks good. I don't build new good decks. I find them. They exist out there. And it's just kind of like the same thing in life. Like you have to like be looking, and you have to be like hopeful, but that you just have to be in the right place at the right time at some point. And and like there's, you just have to have like a degree of patience, I guess.
Maybe I'm reading too much into it, but do you have, and this is like ultra leading question time, but do you have issues talking about your success?
I don't know. I really am someone that believes that you shouldn't talk about your success. I believe that you should do your thing, you should do your craft, and your success or your efforts will speak for you. I believe that you make a good video, make a good stream, make a good podcast, and you put it out there, and it just speaks for itself. I don't think that...
At the end of the day, other people will judge you, and you don't need to judge yourself.
They'll watch you, and they'll form their opinion, and nothing you say will ever convince them, I think, otherwise, you know what I mean? Like, people will watch your content, they'll watch your stream, and they'll decide for themselves how good a deck builder you are. They'll decide how good you are and how much they like you, and they'll stay if they like you, and they won't if you don't. There's no point in bragging about building this or that deck. There's no point in saying I'm the best fucking brewer, I'm the best streamer.
I'm God's gift to Magic.
Yeah, and it's not that I'm like, it's not that I'm humble.
Not that you are. I'm not implying.
Yeah,
that,
yeah. But. It's not that I'm like, oh, I hope I just don't like to talk about it. I don't think that there's a point. I don't think it's like an effective.
It's actual counterproductive. Right?
Yeah, I think it's counterproductive to talk about your success. I think there's no point, and I think it ends up just being a lot of like wasted air. I don't know.
Okay.
Yeah.
I want to go back to something else, which is your brewing process for Magic, for Modern, and then sort of intersected what you told me at the beginning, which is kind of like now you're playing these like Modern Pro Tours, and I interviewed Kai Bude recently, and he, you know, he talked about working with you. So were there like certain I don't even want to call them levels, but just like, have you thought about deck building and Magic a little bit differently now that you had a chance to work with these world-class players? You know, they're probably coming from an entirely different angle, right? So it's almost like two worlds colliding in a way, even though it's Magic the Gathering.
Yeah, like yes, I feel like testing at the Barcelona house this year was so productive for me, and I think it's also like a big part of the reason why I feel like my deck building was so good last year. Meeting Kai, talking with Kai was incredible. It's just like I don't know. I just feel like I was meeting.
I mean, that is Michael Jordan, right?
Yeah,
or
exactly.
The German Michael Jordan.
He's so cool.
Dirk Nowitzki. I don't know.
Yeah, I also want to say, just like as a person, like I feel like I got along with Kai really well. Like I just feel like we ended up becoming like real friends after that. It was just, he was just so good to hang out with. But you know him and Reed and Luis and Nassif and all the members of the team. Edgar was so good too. Like I just playing against him a couple times, like I feel like everyone had like their own individual talents and skills, and I just felt so spongy. And
yeah, sorry, which Edgar was this?
I don't know Edgar's last name. I don't know. Like I met
is
him
it
at the
Edgar
house.
From Canada. Or is
from
it,
Canada?
Is
yeah,
it
Edgar the... from Canada. I love him.
Okay.
I met him
Edgar
at the house.
M. I can't pronounce his last name.
I don't know.
Sorry,
I met him at the house. I feel like we became friends, and I don't know. His Twitter handle is EdgarMTG, I'm pretty sure, and I don't know his last name.
It's just EdgarMTG. Okay. But you learned a ton from all these folks, right?
Yeah, okay. I did. It was just it was just awesome. Like I would wake up at 8 a.m. I would play Magic until like midnight, and that was like every day for a week. And it was in with like just the best players in the world too. It was really, really cool experience.
Was it something that you directly learned from the players, or is it just kind of like osmosis? You're just absorbing things, like just.
I would say that like the majority of it was osmosis, because it's like, I mean, you're kind of like at a certain level. You're mm-hmm. everybody like understands things similarly. It's not like I'm like this inexperienced player who like, learning all these things. But a lot of it was like play patterns and play styles that were like a little bit unique to the individual players that I feel like I was able to absorb. Like a lot of them were playing things in ways that like most proficient, most expert level, most master level players wouldn't necessarily even consider. And it wasn't always right, but they would consider lines and take them occasionally that were correct, even though I think if you're like expert level, you just dismiss those lines immediately, if that makes sense. And like one big weakness I've always had as a Magic player is I play very intuitively. I think there are two types of players: intuitive players, calculating players. Mm-hmm. And I think I'm a very good intuitive player, but I'm not perfect. And I can get overwhelmed in those moments where I don't know what to do. Like I've played, you know, thousands and thousands of matches. I know what to do. I know what the best lines are. But in these unique moments, I can get flustered and I can be unfocused. And it's just like something small Reed Duke said to me during the testing. And I was kind of in one of these moments after like in the middle of like a 12-hour day and it's hot and I'm sweaty. There's no AC in Spain. I couldn't figure out the line. He just like he talked out loud about how each individual line would do. He just like spoke out loud. Wait, let's take our time. Let's figure it out. What happens if this happens? What happens if that happens? And maybe this is just simple, but I've started to do that. Every single time I'm in a bad moment, I just literally think like word for word, what happens if this happens? I just take as much time as I need, and it's been phenomenal. And then also like, I don't know, like all these players are great. I really do feel like Reed Duke is like just at like the pinnacle of like mindset when it comes to Magic. And he said something when we were like working on our sideboard plans for the Yawgmoth deck. He talked about how he's going to visualize the sideboard games going. Like, I want this because of the way I'm visualizing the sideboard games going. And that's not something I'd ever heard described before. The idea, like, we're just sitting and just thinking what the game is going to look like. Like, trying to, like, see the future. at least that's what, ever since he said that, too, that's what I've been trying to do when sideboarding. I just try, like, especially when I'm not streaming, when I'm playing RCQs, I just kind of, like, close my eyes. I try to see the future, try to imagine my like first five plays, their first five plays, and like what I don't want to happen to my hand and what I do want to happen to my hand when I'm sideboarding. And that's become, that was like probably my biggest level up moment of the year, was like Reed saying that.
Just, wow, that's amazing. It's almost like that Donnie Yen movie, I don't remember the name of, where like he's visualizing the fight that hasn't happened yet and exactly how it would play out, and then it goes back to the present time, and then it plays out that way because he anticipated it, sort of thing.
That's what I try to do, and obviously it's not perfect, and you can't see the future, and it sounds kind of like dumb and silly, but for me,
it works. Just putting like a framework really and well. Language around it sounds like that's what Reed was trying to do.
Yeah,
right?
That's a really good way to put it, because I've always been such an intuitive player who like plays like through experience, and I just get so many hours, having that language around what you're supposed to be doing is something I hadn't seen or hadn't like really read. Like the very high technical stuff is a lot of times very unspoken among high level Magic players. It's all kind of understood and in like something that you're doing, but I have a hard time articulating. I think a lot of Magic players have a hard time articulating. I think Reed is just so good at like saying exactly what he's doing, exactly what he's thinking, and I think that's like just what puts them at like the pinnacle of like Magic mindset.
Yeah, and I know this is not exactly the same as preparing for a pro tour, but just watching you and Reed stream, you have such different styles, right? As you said, you're more of an intuitive player. So sometimes I watch you play and you're really good at streaming because you have that what I would call like two brains, where it's like you have the brain that can interact with chat and just talk, and you have the brain that's playing magic. And when you have that intuitive magic brain, you can really multitask well. Whereas I feel like whenever I watch Reed streams, again, this is not indicative of him playing at the Pro Tour level, but like he would actually go into like a 5 or 10 minute tank sometimes, like literally just not say anything on the stream. And I'm just watching and I'm just like thinking about what you just said, which is like you two have very different styles. It's like your brains work differently. But I think part of magic is also kind of training your brain to accommodate like different modes, right? That's kind of what you're implying, I think.
You were absolutely right about my streaming process. I very much am subconsciously playing the game, like not like thinking out my decisions too much, just
because
like,
you can interact with like, the non-game stuff.
I play super fast, and I just play with my subconscious mind,
and it's usually
just
right too, even though you're playing super fast. I see that. So
yeah, I mean I make my fair share of mistakes, but it's also like it's good to do that on stream. It's good to like play as fast as you can so that the tempo is engaging and exciting, and like I'm just like consciously engaging with chat, responding to questions, and then talking out my lines as I play them. And I that is absolutely the case, that I am like very aware that is my process on stream, is I am just focused on chat and focused on being entertaining, and I just kind of like let my intuition play the matches of Magic. And when I'm playing like serious tournament Magic, I'm playing RCs, I'm playing tournaments on stream, I don't do that. I do just try to use both halves of my brain on the stream. Normal, just casual stuff. That is how I do it.
Now, you mentioned Reed giving you sort of, I'll call it like a new tool in your toolbox. It's not like you're revamping what you're doing or your toolbox. Like, it's just a new tool. But were there also things in that PT process or preparation process that kind of made you almost like a first principles, like there's something I need to actually deconstruct about how I'm playing or thinking about Magic that's actually wasn't entirely correct, like I have to rebuild something? Did it ever get that drastic?
I think that there was a lot that changed about my like tournament deck selection process. We had an internal like database of matches where we had matches that we were playing like online or on stream or off stream in leagues and stuff. We would record all of those, and we would record like all of our matches internally. And what was really, really, really cool about that was like we had some decks that were performing incredibly well off stream, or sorry, on stream or like in leagues. Like a good example is the Dimir Ring deck. We were all playing it and our win rates were like crazy, like 65, 70% for everybody. And we would play them internally and the win rates was like 45%, 48%, stuff like that. And it's because like we were able to leverage like skill advantage on the other players with like these versatile interactive cards and just crush our opponents. But internally, we're all like near the same level, around the same level. You just can't do that so much. And so you're like, your control deck is just not, it's not the right choice for this environment, because your opponents are, they're also good. They're pro tour players. You're not going to be able to crush them like you could crush league opponents. And this like has to factor into your deck selection. And this was like also kind of like my, and I think, you know, Reed and like the people who played Yawgmoth also had this mindset too, kind of going in, that we had a really good list, we had really good sideboard plans, and we'd be able to like just outplay our opponents. And I found myself just not able to like crush these pro tour players like I'm able to crush everyone else. Like they're also incredibly good, super high level. You just can't outplay them. And so like this is something that I have started to think more about in my tournament selection, is like, what environment am I going into? What kind of can I play this super complicated deck that people aren't familiar with and use that to overwhelm them? Or is my opponents, are they going to be with it? And I just have to find the best deck, highest card quality, and find something that's as well positioned as I can. And I think that was something that was like, I mean, I think my head was like a little too big for other tournaments, and I would just like gravitate towards really complicated stuff and just try to big brain my way through every single tournament I've ever played.
This is really interesting, because I remember there was actually a Twitter thread or something where somebody was saying, like, when something is X percent versus the field, do you mean the general aggregate of Magic players playing the deck on Magic Online or or large tournaments, paper tournaments, or do you mean like actual, you know, the best players in the world piloting that deck? Now, obviously there's a difference, but then my question is like, what does it actually mean in practice? Like, for example, if something is like in general aggregate, like 55% versus the field, do you just basically have to then play with Pro Tour players to figure out what is that 55%? And doesn't everything get downshifted or upshifted once you're like calibrating for better players anyway? So I'm not sure like how that, or are you talking about decks that have a specific, like some sort of like extreme advantage, like against the field that may not actually be valid at all?
Yeah, it's, I mean, it's all very complicated and situational, but like what really, what it is like every deck has like a skill cap. You know, like if you're playing it perfectly, this is like how well it's positioned against, you know, anybody else playing perfectly too. And that, I think that's like what true matchups are like. This is like, this is kind of like the internal data, the internal testing. People are playing very high level. They're very focused. They're mulliganing super aggressively. I think like there's like no better example of like this dynamic than like the Tron versus like Rakdos Scam matchup, where like going into that Pro Tour, everyone assumed, thought Scam was just like super, super crushing Tron. And then I remember I was like testing with Jim Davis and we were playing both sides of the Tron Scam matchup, and Tron was like about 50-50 with Rakdos after like 100 games. And we would play, it was cool too, is we could play the game super fast. We could get a game done in like 3 minutes after mulligans, 2 minutes after mulligans, where it's just all over in the first three turns. You can concede super fast once like it's super deterministic. But this was like just a way different data point, where like I think like your average in the field Tron player is just missequencing their cards by a very significant margin. I think you're, and this is something that also I say on stream a lot when people talk about Tron players, is that how people talk about how easy the deck is to play and how it's a brainless deck, but it is incredibly nuanced how you sequence and how you mulligan. And I like, and how can it be so easy if the vast majority of Tron players are missequencing and miss mulliganing with the deck too? So I know this, I've kind of strayed off the question, but it's just very complicated. And I think that you also kind of have to understand each game individually. Like this, for my last like regional championship testing on Magic Online, I was playing this mono green deck, and I beat the Somalia combo deck that was new almost every time I played it. But I also knew my opponents could have beaten me if they had played better almost every time. And so I went into it very unsure what was going to happen.
Right. So you were tentative because you actually knew what was up.
Yeah. It's just a very complicated, interesting thing. And you just have to like, I don't think you can really break it down to like one method is the best or like one data point is the best. You just have to understand what it is you're looking at. Like, you know, are you looking at best players versus best players, field versus best players, field versus field? You just have to understand what you're looking at and take it with a grain of salt.
Maybe just question your assumptions. Just always think twice before you make some sort of conclusion that you kind of have it all figured out, right?
Yeah, I think that is something I always try to do. I always try to like understand what it is I'm looking at. Actually, I was talking with my fiance, Esther, about this yesterday, how when I was in school, I was always very good at math, where algebra, geometry, physics, the formulas, I understood why the formulas worked. I understood why the math worked the way it did. And I loved it. And I was really into it. I was very good. And then I hit calculus and I didn't understand it. And I had a very difficult time understanding why calculus worked the way it does, why the formulas worked. And I tried to have my teacher explain it to me, and they just wouldn't. they just couldn't figure it out. Yeah, I don't know if they understood it either. They just wanted me to memorize the formulas, and I was like incredibly uninterested in memorizing it, and I, you know, dropped out of college. And if you know,
so it's not even just about being an intuitive Magic player, but you also need to be an intuitive learner, right? That's also your style.
Yeah, I think so.
Or like, you need to understand the reasons behind it.
Yeah, I have like this compulsive need to understand things. I think I have a need to like understand like why Magic decks are working the way they do. I have a need to understand why math works the way it does. I have a need to understand why,
like you can't have someone just tell you like this is just the best deck, just play it. Like you have to figure it out, you have to test it out, or you have to see for yourself.
Yeah, I need to understand why it's the best deck. I need to understand why the matchups are like this. Actually, today on stream, like someone described Ancient Stirrings in my deck as clunky, And I just very, very genuinely wanted to understand what they meant
you,
as that.
You asked why?
Yeah, like, we had like a...
Why they thought that.
Yeah, we had a really good conversation about like what Magic players mean by the word clunky index. And we had like probably like 8 or 9 different definitions of like what this means. And like I'm a big believer in like getting like vernacular better, having these productive questions and like understanding what's like not, don't just take the feedback, try to understand like what this feedback means, like what it really means that they're saying. And I don't know why, but I do have like this compulsive need to understand.
Is it hard though when you're playing something on stream and someone says like this is clunky? I mean, my level one response would be like getting kind of defensive, like, you know, that are you kind of questioning what I've thought through, and I have a good reason to play Ancient Stirrings, and you're kind of, I don't know, was that your level one reaction? That would be mine, but so I'm not in your shoes.
That's like maybe my level one reaction when someone will go like, your deck's trash, or, oh, there's actually one
That's an obvious insult something. But if I
don't exactly know what you mean, I want to know. I want to know what the feedback is, and I'm very open to like criticism on deck building feedback, as long as you're not being, you know, a jerk. And very rarely do you see anybody actually genuinely being rude in your comments. The majority of the time, and I'm guilty of this, it's just like comments tone is hard to interpret, and most people are being nice even when you think they're being kind of rude about your stuff. But I really want to know what people think and feel about the stuff I put out, and I don't think I'm super sensitive to that kind of feedback. I don't know.
Okay. Did it change for you over time, or were you always like that? Did streaming allow you to grow like a thicker skin or something?
You would think. I remember I went into streaming thinking I was kind of worried about this, like, oh, I'm a content creator, I'm a person on the internet, oh, I'm gonna get like these hate comments or people are gonna be rude. But like basically as soon as I started streaming, it's like if a comment was like rude or bad or whatever, but it wasn't like true, it's just funny. It's not something that touches me if it's
like, not reality, right?
Yeah, it's not reality. Yeah. Or if like this deck is bad and trash, but I'm like doing well and I believe with it. It's just funny. I know they're not watching, or no, I know they're not understanding, or I just don't really care. But when a comment is like negative but accurate, it does get me for sure when someone like they see what it is for real.
Is there something that still lives like rent free in your head, like after, you know, a year or something?
I don't know, not really. There's this one time, and it's become like a meme on the channel. There is a chatter who who went !DAC, and that's the command to pull the deck list up in the chat. And then just type the word bad, and then type the word buy, and it's just funny/mean.
It was funny,
but also like they were right. Like that deck was a bad deck. They were not wrong, and it was just I don't know, that one is memorable because it was so funny. But I don't know. It's like I also like sometimes I'll get like a little heated on stream, and like I like to play it up a little bit, and I just always like leave the stream at I just leave and live my life after it's over.
When was the last time you got genuinely mad while you were streaming?
I don't know. Angry,
maybe upset with yourself.
I don't know. Last week, this week, pretty today. Frequently. Today, maybe. I know that I like to kind of like play it up. And if there is someone who says something silly, I like to play it up and try to like banter a little bit and like kind of feign being worked up on stream. And this is usually just like entertainment value a little bit. And it's like, I think because I do that, I don't really ever get heated, like genuinely heated, you know?
Okay.
I'll try to like joke about it, and I'll try to like feign that I'm frustrated, or feign that this is frustrating, because I turn it into a bit and make it entertaining that I'm getting worked up and I'm getting frustrated about this. And but it's all just fun, I think.
Okay, because I just jumped into a stream, random stream, another one the other day, And there was a guy, I don't want to say who they are, but like who he is, but like just genuinely just salting off for 20 minutes straight. And it was just really, really unpleasant to watch. And I this is kind of like a commentary slash question. Like, have you ever been that kind of person? Like just pure salt lord and just, you know, when things were not going well for you in terms of gameplay or something?
I've definitely had like moments. It's really rare that like my salt,
but not like for 20 minutes straight.
Yeah,
right?
No, it's pretty short. Like I remember like this last weekend in the challenge, I like had an opponent who like I like thought sees them and they drew the perfect like all three games, like just like yeah. runner like exactly what they need. It was just so tough. But it's not something that like lasts long at all. Like it's for me, it's like just like 30 seconds to a minute of pain, and
seconds of pain and move on.
Yeah, I try not to. I try my best not to express those frustrations on stream unless I feel like it's entertaining, and I feel like that frustration,
sure.
that pain.
You
is,
play it up, maybe.
Yeah. You play it up and try to make a joke about it, and like I like because I do think like seeing your streamer get frustrated is entertaining, and it's I think it's like a fun, healthy way as the streamer to like get rid of those emotions, to play it up and to like exacerbate and exaggerate your frustration.
But at some point when some streamers like go way overboard, they even forget they're playing on stream and they start berating their opponents. That's not a good look.
Yeah, I think it's not a good look. I'm a big believer in sportsmanship and like, you know, respecting your opponents, and I don't know. I feel like I used to be super duper overly polite, especially like on stream, and over time I've become a lot more relaxed. But I like to think that like core of like
is that a Texan thing or
maybe it's I mean my parents I think are super duper polite too, and it's a Texan thing, but I also like genuinely do like to be nice to people, and I like to be polite. I like when people are nice to me too. It's just nice. I don't know. Yeah,
just feels better.
Yeah, it feels better.
Are you able to talk about your consulting work for Modern Horizons?
I did not consult for Modern Horizons.
Lord of the Rings, I should say.
Yeah, I did.
Modern Horizon 3, unofficially.
I did Lord of the Rings, and I did Assassin's Creed, and then they asked me to do MH3 also, but I said no because they wanted me to go to Seattle for like 6 weeks.
What, you turned that down?
Yeah, I think
it was... You're aspiring Spike.
Well,
I'm
think
just making a joke at your ego.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think it was right to turn it down because it's like... 6 weeks of not streaming is like very scary. And I don't know. I also have two dogs that, you know, I don't want to be away for 6 weeks, and my fiance for 6 weeks. And I think it was like it would have been the wrong career move to do. And it would have been the wrong like personal life thing to do as well. It would have been very fun. It would have been a really fun, very cool experience, but I don't regret turning it down.
I think the timing is really interesting just for me as an interviewer, because I literally just interviewed Canister a few weeks ago about his work consulting for Lord of the Rings. And I also interviewed Mason Clark, who actually did go to Seattle for a couple of months. So yeah. I feel like I made a joke with Mason about like, is there some correlation between tall Magic players and Magic playing ability? Because you guys are both tall and you guys are both seem to play Magic pretty well. I don't know. It's like you and him, right?
A lot of people say me and Mason look a lot alike too, which I don't really
see. That is
see.
Not true at all.
Yeah, I think it maybe was more true when my hair was shorter. But it's something that people every time
some sort of
every
weird
time,
Spider-Man meme where you guys are like indistinguishable.
Every time I see Mason, he does do that. He goes, "It's like I'm looking at a mirror here." He's like he likes to really play it up.
But you're not seeing it, right?
I don't know. Mason's very handsome. I'll take the compliment. Yeah, I mean, I can answer. If I can't say something, I won't say it. But I don't think.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I just wanted to know. Just sort of, I watched Canister's video where he talked about Lord of the Rings. I mean, just from your perspective, what was the experience like from start to finish?
So it was for me. It was a very stressful time in general, where I was in the middle of. I maybe talked about this the last Humans of Magic episode, but I was in the middle of a trophy race. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but this was like back before the Pro Tour came out, and I was doing like for the entire like 90-day season, I was trying to get as many 5-0s in the Modern League and be at the top of the leaderboard. And I put like I bought these like real expensive trophies, and I like put like real prizes up,
right,
and,
to give to the winner. Yeah, I remember that.
And there was like there was like four people like very seriously competing, and it was a very dead heat. Misplaced Ginger, Meninone, and Demonic Tutors. We were all grinding like all day, and like at the very beginning of the starting, I got reached out to do consulting for the Lord of the Rings stuff, and it was like super exciting, very cool opportunity. I was just so excited to do it, and it was like just kind of like dream come true to be able to consult on something like this. And you know, they reached out and they wanted that for my role and Canister's role was to take a look at the existing cards in the set and give feedback on the cards, and like either say this card is going, we're specifically look for cards that are going to be too powerful, too broken, or suggest changes to make cards that need a little bit of a push to be like playable, and like explain that too. And I think that was awesome, really cool role to be in. It's very stressful for me at the time because I'm like, I wake up, grind on stream for like, I was doing very long streams, like 8, 9, sometimes 10 hours a day, every day. I had 2 written articles a week and a YouTube video a week due for Channel Fireball at the time, which I'm not doing those anymore. And then I would have the consulting work to do after that. And so my days were,
the whole day was magic.
Yeah. The consulting process, I think, was a month, and it was like really just, it was really wake up magic until I'm asleep every day for a month. It was very tough, but it was very cool too. And you know, so like the way it worked was we'd go through the set, give our first impressions, feedback. That was like, there was like feedback given back from our feedback. And then there was like a revision of the set. Like they had changed a lot about the cards. That was sent to us. We gave our feedback there. Canister talked a lot about like what that individual feedback was in his video. I was going to do a video also on the Lord of the Rings feedback. His was so good. So high quality. I'm like, this covers it.
He's got it covered.
All right. But I remember one funny thing was like the One Ring when I saw it was like a 5-mana. It was a 5-mana artifact. It was indestructible, and it basically did nothing. It was very underpowered.
Yeah.
It was very uninteresting. It was like not even a card I think EDH players would like. And I remember giving the feedback like, this is the One Ring. It's such an iconic card.
Right.
It's so interesting. It is. Like, why is this basically do nothing?
Why is it like this?
And I gave the feedback that I wish that this was, I like a different design. I wish that this was like something good and interesting. And I didn't see the current version of the One Ring. I'm told that it was a very like late change, like a very late late addition. But it's just kind of funny to think about how that happened, but I did get my wish. The ring ended up being very iconic and very very powerful.
That's I mean, obviously this is a sample size of one because it's one set, but I am curious if you know whether or not Magic cards tend to start off being more conservative in power level and then they ramp it up over time or at the finish line.
So
instead of the other way around.
I guess I also did Assassin's Creed, but I haven't seen how those cards have finished up, so I guess we'll see.
Yeah. Time will tell.
It's for me, it was a very big mix of both. There was a big mix of like, this card needs to be a little bit stronger to be at the right power level, or this card needs a couple of nerfs. Like, I actually also like Flame of Anor, I think, was like word for word the same from when I saw it. But I remember thinking like, I think it should deal 3 damage instead of 5 damage was one piece of feedback I gave. But also like back then, like Snapcaster was like a much more considered card, although like Flame of Anor like did bring it back into the format. It's like it's just a lot of like I think Magic designers are very good. I genuinely believe we're living in like the golden age of Magic design right now. I think that we had the age of like War of the Spark to Kaldheim was a nightmare, and I think after that it's been really, really good. And I think that the designers are very good, and that they're throwing the dart at the dartboard, and they get it around the right power level the vast majority of the time. And it's just a lot of like small tweaks there to not only like get the power level appropriate, but also to make the card interesting and like exciting too.
Right.
It's like, it is such a difficult job to make the cards fun and to make the cards interesting and also not destroy the game and make it
Yeah.
I even like hesitate to use the word balance, even though like that is something you should strive for in a big way as a designer. Like, I think that you do need a degree of like hot and cold. And this is something they've done a great job of. This is like the exact thing that they do so good at, is that they make cards that you read them and you're like, this is insane. This is broken. This is so exciting.
But a good first impression.
Yeah, good first impression cards, but they're not. But they do that so often now. The cards you read that you just get excited about.
They get you excited for like preview season and brewing, and they might not end up being super great, but it's like it gets you that first impression.
They almost always aren't super great. Sometimes
look at this legend. I'm going to build my whole deck around this or this card, right? Yeah.
Yeah, but I think they do a really good job of it too. And so like getting to be like a small part of that process was really exciting. Like I had a few like moments I thought like were really exciting to me personally, where Stern Scolding, the first time I saw it said counter target creature spell power 2 or less, and I suggested power or toughness 2 or less, mostly so it could counter Lurrus, but also counter Solitude was like a really important thing at the time, and that is just like how the card was changed. It was power 2 or less, now it's power toughness, and it is super relevant that it's the toughness. And then like the card Lost a Legend is right now, I guess I saw it said put target, I think it was enchantment or legendary creature, forth from the top, and I suggested changing that to historic permanent, because like I thought the flavor of the word historic fit really well on the card name Lost to Legend, and it was already like a recently keyworded word.
Kind
too.
Of a flavor consideration as well.
Yeah. And they ended up changing. But I also said it should be historic permanent so it can get Urza Saga, because it's a legendary.
You had an agenda, sure.
But,
yeah.
But they changed. Yeah. But they changed it to non-land historic permanent. So I don't get to. So I, like, oh, I feel like I would have put that card in a lot of decks if it was my initial suggestion. But it's I'm just very happy that the word historic is like on that card because I suggested it. Yeah.
Did they give you direction? Like you're supposed to just analyze it in the context of competitive modern, because that's kind of your background, or did you have to consider other things as well?
Yeah, that was like, we were given a lot of like freedom, and like we were given like the like quotas on like how many cards we had to talk about, or like how many words. It was just like analyze the set in the context of competitive modern. Tell us if there's any, we were like specifically said, tell us if there's any Hogax, tell us if there's any Okos, tell us if there's any anything.
You guys are the quality control, yeah, the control.
Quality control.
Yeah.
But also, you know, but also like we want the set to be powerful. We want things to be pushed. And
yeah,
it was kind
of. I think Canister mentioned that video, like there was some sort of like kind of overall thing. Like we want like a certain X number of cards to be like super players, right?
Yeah, and I think that they like hit the number pretty well. I can't remember the exact numbers, but I do think that they wanted like two super good cards, and they wanted like a dozen like other role players. And
we definitely got at the top.
Yeah. I think Lord of the Rings was a big success. It was really a set people were sweating for a long time. Like there was the meme, like I'm gonna cast Gandalf.
Is there gonna be any good cards?
Yeah. Or is it like gonna be the next Modern Horizons?
I think there was like a second when people previewed the One Ring and they were like not sure if it was gonna be good.
Yeah. Oh, I saw the card and I was like,
Were you like love at first sight? Like you
I
were
was like
this
what
is legit.
The fuck? I was like, this card is ridiculous.
So there was no doubt in your mind, basically.
Yeah.
It was like gonna be in every deck.
I saw it for the first time with everybody else too. I was like, this was not in the set.
This is not your mama's One Ring. This is not the One Ring that I saw as a consultant, right? In the 5cc. Yeah.
Yeah, but I don't know. It was a cool experience. I'll say that like also like the team members were like very good at communicating, and I think very good at like it's so cool when you like meet a very enfranchised Magic player, someone who's like very good at what you do, because you just speak like this hidden language. You very much understand these things, and like finding like what you connect on them with, like what you like about the game, what like game philosophies you have that you share, are really, really cool. And like I remember I had a conversation with one of the Wizards employees about how like I feel like it's very good. It's better for Magic players to be hot and cold on a format, or hot and cold on Magic, than to be lukewarm. Like I think that Like, this is kind of the difference between Modern and Pioneer, is Modern players are very hot and cold. They love things about the format, and they hate things about the format, and they're very passionate about it. And Pioneer players, I think, are, like, very largely, you know, lukewarm. They just
different group. Huh?
They're just not that passionate about it, or they don't have as many things they love, and they don't have as many things they hate. And obviously,
also because Modern's been through a lot more.
Yeah, Modern has been through a lot more, and then you kind of have that history and that passion. But, like, obviously, ideally, you know, you would love. It goes without saying, everybody loving it is what you want to shoot for, but.
Sure.
Love and hate is not that bad of a place to be. It is, I think, a pretty good and fun environment, to be honest.
It's almost like what they say about content. It's like you can't be lukewarm and just be down the middle on everything. You kind of have to be, for lack of a better term, like, divisive sometimes. Like, either people love what you are doing or hate what you're doing. Because if you have everyone that just thinks, like, you know, aspiring Spike is average, then it's not really going to get you anywhere, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And be in the middle.
I think so, yeah. And I think it's a good way to live your life, too. You know, you want to. I always
to stand for something, right?
Yeah, be very.
Yeah, you might miss
very
some
polarized.
Shots, but
yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you didn't go to Seattle, but do you think there could be some sort of long-term future for you as a designer of some game, not even just Magic?
Maybe. So, like, to be honest, like, with the recent Wizards layoffs, like, you know, like, I'd always kind of talked about, like, oh, maybe I'll go work for Wizards one day. That idea has become a lot less appealing.
Hey, man, cycles. You never know in the future.
We'll see. Yeah, yeah. Maybe, but that's become a lot less appealing. I have been, as a personal project, working on a TTRPG with a friend. We have,
you mentioned
that. Yeah, one of my rooms is, like, a chaos room with, like, a whiteboard, and, like, we have, like, paper cutters for, like, making
cards. So talk to me about that. How do you end up... I know you were always big on D&D, but how do you create a TTRPG?
Okay, so my best friend, he's going to be my best man. He was living in Utah. He just recently moved back. But at one point last year, I helped him move his two golden retrievers from here to Utah. We did a road trip across the country, and we've been playing. He taught me to play Magic 12 years ago, actually, and he doesn't really play anymore. But we've been playing D&D together for, like, 6 years, and we had been playing D&D, and we switched to Pathfinder, like, maybe 2 or 3 years ago. And there's things we like about both systems, and there's things we dislike about both. And so
you want to make something for yourself.
Yeah. The goal is to make a system that, like, blends, like, what we like about both. That was the initial goal. And we spent, like, you know, the entire trip over there, and, like, hours after, like, working on that. And we found, I don't want to say too much, actually, because I think we have a very exciting idea that I really don't want to spoil the sauce yet. But we found a way to, like, incorporate, like, card game mechanics and, like, board game mechanics into, like, the dice rolling that actually makes it, like...
That sounds super sweet, man.
Yeah, it's more interesting than just rolling the dice over and over again is the goal. To make, like... Because D&D is really fun.
So there's some sort of deck building involved.
Yeah, yeah. Like, the D&D is really fun because you get to... play your character and play with your friends, but, like, the actual, like, mechanics of the game, it could be more fun. Like,
oh, I see. So you want, like, the best of, which is the role playing or the social aspect, but you want, like, another engine.
Yeah,
basically.
Yeah. We're really, like, reinventing the engine, and so I hopefully that'd be something I could, like, post online at some point and share. But my friend he's taking paternity leave later this year, and he says, when I'm on paternity leave, I want to treat this as a full-time job. I want to come over as often as I can and work on this.
Okay.
And so that hopefully we can get that hammered out soon.
How do you guys plan to get it out? Is it going to be, like, a Kickstarter? Is it going to be, like, a free thing that,
like,
just comes out?
The thing is, it's like, really, like, for us and our group, but we have talked about, like, posting it online, doing
so it's still homebrew.
Doing a Kickstarter.
Okay.
Yeah, we've talked about maybe doing that, doing the Kickstarter, but we have, like, you know, the time and energy to, like, work on it ourselves without, like, needing Kickstarter money to, like, you know, support anything. But if we were ever...
passion project.
Yeah, if we were going to publish it, you know, maybe at some point. But yeah, it's just a passion project, just, you know, for fun.
Yeah. Make it fun. That's the way, man. Just make it fun for you guys first. Like, refine it, make sure it's super fun, and then you can figure out how to go wide. If you want to go wide later, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Exactly.
Not everything you build in life has to be for everybody, right?
Yeah, so. It's kind of like my stream process. Like, so many ideas never make it to the stream because I don't think they're worth sharing. But if this is an idea worth sharing later, then great. And if it's not, that's fine. It wasn't worth sharing anyway.
Have you ever thought about doing, I don't know if you already have a Patreon, but just doing like a Patreon for all your graveyard decks, or like, you know, like the B-sides, you know, Aspiring Spike B-sides.
I've thought about it. It is something that gets requested a lot, but it's also like, the thing too is like, when you are like a full-time content creator, you at any point in your day can be working. At any point in your day, you can be doing something.
Oh yeah, there's no on off. Yeah. You have to set boundaries.
And you have to figure out like what is the best effective use of your time. Cuz like for me, like the brewing process, it's way better for me if I'm not like making content out of it. If I'm just focused and I'm like changing things rapidly and moving the cards, I'm just focused on doing the thing rather than like writing an article about it or taking screenshots and documenting as I go and like breaking that concentration and then taking the time to post it there. I think it's just for the best and the most effective if I just with this process I have, rather than just trying to like have a vlog camera, you know, next to me, you know, all hours of the day.
Yeah, it's, I mean, everyone's different, but it sounds like you don't want to be like documenting your life 24/7. Like, it's not like you're walking to the Arby's and you feel like I need to like do a selfie video now, or like I'm brewing a deck where I'm just playing Magic because I enjoy playing Magic. You don't have to document every second.
Yeah,
of it, right?
Yeah. Like for me, it's like content is not because like I'm super excited to get, you know, share my life necessarily or share like me. I like to share my ideas. I like content when I'm
there's
sharing
a creative like distillation or concentration that you want to, a select thing that you want to share, not all of it, right?
Exactly. Like I'm not really interested in it being in front of a camera if I don't think I have something like interesting to say, if that makes sense. And and like and specifically like content around the uninteresting stuff is like just kind of the opposite of like what I like to do.
It sounds like you've never grown that ego where it's like, because you have some success in Magic, you feel like now all the non-Magic stuff is suddenly interesting and everyone would be really into it if they only knew the real you, kind of thing.
Yeah, I've never had that thought that my life is so interesting. I'll become this like YouTube vlogger. I get to share every.
You haven't anyone request the Spike OnlyFans or like the 24/7 access to you.
People have asked. If anything, my Esther, she would love to do like the streaming, like the like that kind of like vlog content. You know, where she like she's wanted to like usually like if after the stream she's the one playing video games and I'm like watching her play video games. She plays like Hades and Tears of the Kingdom and she's like I want to stream. All this, it's, okay. I don't know.
Interesting. Yeah. Everyone just works so differently. That's what's cool about it. Can we do the five questions? Is it okay now?
Yeah, sure. That's fine.
Okay. All right. So five questions with Aspiring Spike. Let's get to it. Number one, what's the best or most memorable Magic play you ever made?
There used to be a lot of plays I made that I was like super excited about. I used to be like a legacy Ant player. And there was one time I had a very, very like unique hand that contained it's been so long. I can't even remember the exact content, but I had a hand that had a Dark Ritual in it, a hand that could beat a Chalice on one, and could also like pay for days the next turn. But the Dark Ritual in my hand, for some reason, I can't exactly recall. On my turn one, I could cast it, and if I cast it and it resolved, I wasn't going to do anything after that Dark Ritual. I would just pass the turn. But I had Gitaxian Probe my opponent, and I saw that they had Chalice. I knew I could beat the Chalice, and I knew that I couldn't beat that Force of Will any other way because I didn't have like a Duress or Discard spell. And I cast the Dark Ritual knowing my opponent would Force of Will it, and also knowing that if my opponent let it resolve, I would just pass the turn, basically discarding the Dark Ritual. But that is what happened. I cast the Dark Ritual. They Force of Willed it. They played the Chalice, and I was able to untap and kill them. And I used to be able. I can't remember the exact situation. It was like so weird and unique. And I remember it was a team tournament. And I turned to my friend and like told him to watch this, and then he didn't understand what was going on. And I don't know. There was another time. It's actually kind of very similar where I was playing the card Thrasta. It's like an 11 mana dinosaur that costs 3 mana less for each spell cast this turn. And I was doing math, and I realized I was one spell short of being able to cast the Thrasta. I had like 2 mana, I had 3 mana total, and the Thrasher would cost 3 mana, and I, or 3 mana after my next spell, right? So if I tap one of my lands to cast a spell, Thrasher will cost 3, but I only have 2 mana left. And so I had the option to like Abundant Harvest to try to find a 0 mana spell. But what I decided to do was Lightning Bolt to my opponent's Dragavan to get them to counter the Lightning Bolt, which would get the spell count high enough to cast the Thrasher. And I don't know.
That's an amazing feeling. It's like in both of those situations where you needed your, not just you do the right thing, but your opponent to do exactly what you needed them to do in order to make that line work.
Yeah, exactly. That to me, those lines are like very special because they're so hard to see. These like moments where like you trick your opponent into doing something optional, but it is the right play for them to make, and like it lets you go off. It's just so exciting to me that those kind of plays.
To me, those are the kind of things where it's like if there was a perfect AI that could play Magic, like the AI wouldn't be able to figure that stuff out. Because like that's still, to me, it feels like that's still kind of like a human element to the game or the psychology element of the game that is often underrated in Magic, but it's so beautiful when it works out, you know?
Yeah, I agree.
Next question. What's the worst Magic play you ever made and what did you learn from it?
Well, there's
maybe the stakes were high. Yeah, maybe there was a certain point. Everyone has a list.
So one time I did a vintage, was it Vintage Masters? Whenever like there's a set on Magic Online that introduced the Power 9 to Magic Online. I think it was Vintage Masters on Magic Online. And I drafted Ancestral Recall. This is the first time the Power 9 were ever on Magic Online. And the odds of opening them were incredibly low. And I opened an Ancestral Recall. And in my draft, I didn't draw it until my third round, and I drew it. I was so excited. I targeted my opponent with the Ancestral Recall just as a complete like airhead accident. And it felt so, to me, the idea of casting a recall and like draft was so exciting. And that was the only time I cast it in that whole draft.
Hey, it was exciting for the opponent.
Yeah. It was my opponent like typed like ?? In the chat. I don't know. One like non-gameplay mistake I made was I was like 3-1 in a Magic Online PTQ, and I was doing like a draft, and I accidentally dropped from the PTQ instead of the draft that I meant to.
Oh man.
And it was there's actually an emote on my channel of my face after I realized that I had dropped from the PTQ instead of the draft.
Because it was just automatic. Even when you type drop, like you were just sure you were dropping.
Yeah,
it was
like weird because I had the right box, right? I had the right box. I typed it and I wasn't sure. So I exited it and then I clicked on one window and it was the draft window. And then I can't, there's a clip of it that you can see, but it switched to the other window and I dropped for the main one. It was brutal.
Okay. It wasn't entirely your fault. It was like some weird stuff happening with the client.
It was entirely my fault, but it was like kind of, you could see why I was thinking what I was thinking at the moment.
Okay. So maybe the learning is just be careful not to misclick in Magic.
Yeah. Online. I'm always very careful, careful about that. But I don't know. It kind of goes back to my very intuitive play. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's like I don't
but you know how sometimes we overcompensate? Like, is it possible that you've now wasted like several hours of your life just being extra careful with everything on Magic Online? Like, maybe it was better just to not be careful all along because like you can deal with like the occasional mistake. Like, have you thought about that?
Yeah, that's actually like a very conscious thing I do on stream. Like one somewhat common thing is that I'll play a fetch land on turn one and I'll like yield until my opponent's instep. This way the game can go as quickly as possible. Like, I'm streaming, I want the game to be fast and engaging, and my opponents will just go land Pithing Needle and they'll be able to name the fetch line that's in play. And like I'm just like kind of okay when that happens, to be honest.
Oh, I see. Because like the rare time that they do get you,
yeah,
it's not worth like all the times you have to be so careful.
Yeah, exactly. And I just know like as like a streamer, it's just very important to like play quickly and keep the game as engaging as possible. Because Magic,
keep it moving.
Because Magic is slow. You know, it's like it can be tough to watch if the person you're watching is playing, you know, slowly.
What's the biggest Magic level up moment that you can recall?
When I was very, very first learning the game from my friend who I'm now designing the TTRPG system with, I was playing like green, white, like cards that I own. And I remember being so frustrated that all of my cards were being countered. And I just, this is so funny. Like, now 12 years later, but I remember he like tapped out for a Jace memory adapt and I had like my Garrick Primal Hunter in my hand. I remember thinking, I'm just going to play this and he's just going to counter it like he always does. I would always play a counter. And I realized, wait, he has no mana available. Like there were
just tapped out.
There were definitely like plenty of times that like he was tapped out. I was just learning the game for the first time. But like, I remember that. I was like, wow, he's tapped out. Like, okay, this is going to resolve. Like, to me, like that was maybe not my biggest level up moment, but it was my first level up moment.
Yeah. That was like a shift. That was like when you saw the Matrix or something. Yeah.
I don't know. My biggest one lately was definitely that Reed Duke story where like I just like visualizing sideboard post sideboard games. Like looking at the sideboarding, thinking about like what the first five turns are going to look like for both players. That like, to me, I felt like I hadn't had like a super big level up moment until like that point, and that was like definitely my biggest one last year. Was like,
and him having the language or being able to express it, and now you having that language too.
Yeah, and I think it comes back to like my like desire to like understand like how other people think and other people think about the game. The way he was able to just like so easily articulate it was just like a click in my head.
Who's the biggest Magic player influence on you and why?
I mean, there's definitely a lot. This last year, it was like definitely Reed because of like all the stories I've told before. Like as a streamer on Twitch, it's definitely Gabriel Nassif and like his like presence on Twitch and his friendliness and like how good he is with the community and how like good he is with the chat. And like he would never say this about himself, but like Nassif is like one of like the nicest, best community members, and I've always like wanted to be like more like him in that regard, and I always look way up to him because of that. Like Luis Scott Vargas and his playstyle, like very early on, like super influenced me. Caleb D got me into Modern when I was like watching his content back in the day, and the Grixis Delver decks, like I always thought that was so inspiring. Brian Kibler, like he got me into competitive Magic when I was watching his like Pro Tour Dark Ascension run. That was like so exciting to me. It's just so hard to like pick like a single influence. I feel like there's just so many like great people to look.
They're all influences on your progression. Yeah, right on. Question number five, the last one. What's your favorite Magic related travel story?
My favorite thing to do when I go to a city for a Magic tournament is like go to the aquarium in the city afterwards. I did it in Atlanta recently. I've done it in Minneapolis. I've done it in Denver. I've done it in Barcelona. I really like to go to the aquarium after. I don't know if that's my favorite memory from Magic travel.
Why do you like going to the aquarium? You just like the aquatic life, or
yeah, it's like twofold. I do really like fish. I really like aquariums in general. I think sea life is really cool and just fun to look at. But it's also like a really good way to decompress from like a long weekend. Like Magic tournaments are not just the weekend. They're like weeks and months of preparation and talking and late nights and deck selection and like, you know, the pains of like flights and hotels. And just, it's just a good way to like decompress and just like relax and be in a different world for like a second and not like, and get to enjoy like the city you're in and the travel you're in. Like to me, that's always like been like the best part of a weekend is the dinners and the aquariums and like the talking with friends. It's just so good to relax and not think about Magic for a second.
Has there been an aquarium, I assume in the US, like has there been an aquarium that you're particularly impressed with?
The Atlanta aquarium is like I think the best one pretty easily. It's like pretty world renowned. They have a whale shark in a tank. It's so big, it like swims over you, and they have these seals that do like these crazy tricks. It's like very cool.
If you could hang out with an aquatic, is it called mammal or animal? If you could hang out with like something in the water, like what would it be?
I like squids a lot. I feel like hanging out with a giant squid would be probably the death of me. But if I could just be in a submarine, like around one 10,000 feet under the sea, that would be amazing.
For some reason, I'm suddenly thinking of The Boys and The Deep, the character in the show. But let's not go there. I don't know if you've seen that. He's a character that can communicate with aquatic life.
Yeah, I would love that power, and I hope to not abuse it.
The way he has. Okay, well, Spikes, thank you so much for taking the time today. It was great having a nice conversation with you.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. Glad to be on again. Thank you.